Hi, this is Chris O'Brien, and you're listening to the Few and Far Between podcast, conversations on the cutting edge of clinical research. To quote today's guest, the Orphan Drug Act was the first miracle that sparked the orphan drug revolution. Jim Garrity is a biotech industry veteran and the author of Inside the Orphan Drug Revolution, The Promise of Patient-Centered Biotechnology, released in September of this year. As Jim puts it, he stumbled into the orphan drug industry. He began his career at Bain & Company as a consultant and then moved to Genzyme, where he met his mentor, Henry Tremier, a founding father of the biotech industry. Jim has continued to embrace the path of promoting necessity and viability in orphan and rare disease research for both patients and venture capitalists alike. In today's episode, I asked Jim about his biotech journey, the importance of patient centricity in healthcare company culture, and how the Orphan Drug Act got a boost from some notable Hollywood actors in 1983. There are also some management gems, and this is a bird's eye view of the evolution of the biotech industry. I'll also ask Jim if Boston, Massachusetts, my hometown, is truly the epicenter of the biotech industry and why. I'll warn you, I might be a little bit biased about his response. I hope you enjoy this episode. It was really a good one. And I encourage you to read Jim's book, which is terrific, for further insights into the orphan drug revolution, how we got here, and where we're headed. Okay, let's get going. Jim, what a pleasure to be speaking with you today. I've been really looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you, Chris. So have I.
So you had a front row seat for many of the events that you describe in your book, Inside the Orphan Drug Revolution, really a transformation in biotechnology. Will you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got there, how you got that seat?
Sure. I think I say in the book at one point that I stumbled into the orphan drug revolution. And the way that happened was I had started my career in a strategy consulting firm. I'd gone to law school and was looking for a way to make a contribution. I thought that this offered the opportunity to try to learn about company building and help create, you know, interesting enterprises. And I enjoyed it. And I learned a lot, but I found that most of the companies and the clients I was consulting for were very financially focused and focused exclusively on kind of maximizing profitability and returns. And then I started working with one client, which was a healthcare client, and I found a very different culture. And the culture was different because for the company to be successful, it needed to engage the best and the brightest among the scientific and medical physician communities. And to engage people like that, you know, you need a culture that recognizes that, of course, a company has a responsibility to its investors, but it has a kind of almost a higher responsibility to be, you know, patient driven and maintain fidelity to the science. And as I became part of that environment, I was inspired in that situation by seeing that company. We can talk about the specifics a little later, but seeing how that company was engaging with patients, making a dramatic difference in their lives, getting close to their families, it was kind of inspiring to see those stories. I could see the tremendous need and the tremendous ability to contribute. And that seemed to me to offer an opportunity for contribution and a reward that went well beyond the financial rewards in other environments.
Would you say you stumbled into or lucked into this involvement in the world of pharma broadly? How did that happen?
Yeah, I think I would say I stumbled into it and lucked into it both. And, you know, what's interesting, Chris, this may seem like a nuance, and maybe, you know, some of your listeners will seem a little bit maybe splitting hairs, so to speak, but it wasn't actually a pharma company. It was a company called Baxter Travonol, today called Baxter, and it had a different culture. It didn't produce drugs. It was a diversified healthcare company. And the reason that was so different is it had a culture. And this was actually written up in another book that was partially a background to my book, which was about how the origins of the biotech industry, how many CEOs came from Baxter, a book written by a woman named Monica Higgins at Harvard Business School called Career Imprints. It talked about the unique culture at Baxter. And the culture was unique in the sense that because it wasn't a big pharma company, it was a decentralized collection of businesses and products and programs and services that the general managers in those units were very close to their patients and their customers. They had to draw on them very much to develop the therapies and the services that they were providing. And so that culture had even a greater, you know, connection to patients and many big pharma companies had at the time.
That's fascinating. One of the things that I have enjoyed about the book and about our conversation so far is I keep feeling like I'm learning things about things I thought I understood. So I thought I knew what Baxter was. I didn't realize that's what the origin story was. So would you double click on that a little bit for us? What do you think particularly about the culture made it a place that generated lots of CEOs and business leaders?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to double click because I think it's important. I think the overall environment was cultivated and nurtured by Baxter's longtime CEO, a man named Bill Graham, and this is all written up in Monica's book, A Career Imprints. But when I was started working there, the vision and group that I was working with was a group that was making products from pooled human plasma for blood diseases. And the most important product and the most important patient group that they served was for hemophilia. And in the late 1960s and 70s, hemophilia care had reached a remarkable peak of a value and a benefit. Patients with hemophilia were living much better lives as a result of these very valuable, powerful products sourced from pooled human plasma, the concentrates, factor concentrates that they needed. But in around 1981, the HIV crisis struck and devastated the blood supply, of course. And all of a sudden, all of these very effective therapies started transmitting AIDS throughout the hemophilia community. And the hemophilia community, of course, was devastated by the AIDS epidemic in the early 1980s. And so at Baxter, I was working with the leader of the hemophilia group, a man named Henry Tremere, who many of your listeners, I think, will know. And, you know, Baxter faced many challenging decisions at that point because hemophilia is a genetic disease. It's a relatively small, rare population compared to a lot of other much larger indications. You know, Baxter served hospitals across the world and all of the things that hospitals do. And many people felt that Baxter couldn't afford to invest in everything that would be required to provide, you know, to continue to maintain leadership in this field. And there were two things that needed to be done. One was that immediate improvements needed to be made to purify the products coming out of the blood supply to prevent the transmission of the HIV virus. But that was a short-term fix. And the long-term solution, of course, was the ability to provide products from other sources like, you know, genetically engineered or recombinant products. And Henry was the champion of those investments. And he championed them both because they made sense for Baxter, but primarily, quite honestly, out of a kind of a moral compass that as a leader in the field, this was an obligation that a company like Baxter had, and it had to make the investments necessary to provide the best possible products. And that was kind of an inspiring mission. And it led to tremendous improvements in care and ultimately a very safe set of recombinant products from the biotech industry. And then it was, you know, I ended up following Henry. We can talk about this later. He went on to become the head of Genzyme and more or less build Genzyme from the ground up. And I joined him there. And that same culture at Baxter was replicated, I think, and in some ways even more intensely at Genzyme afterwards.
Yeah, let's go to Genzyme now. But I guess closing out on that point, if I understand what you're saying, a combination of a few things came into play there. So Henry was a visionary CEO willing to take a risk and also someone who had a strong moral compass on the importance of committing to new treatments to address the crisis. You had a giant crisis at the same time, and you had a well-funded company that had lots of talented folks inside it. Is that right? It was all of those things coming together that created something unusual at Baxter. And then I guess that then catapulted Henry to the next thing.
Yeah, I think that's very well summarized. That built on the emergence of biotechnology. That was also So, you know, 1980 was the year when Genentech went public, and that was the culmination of the fruits of 25 years. That was about 25 years after Watson and Crick in 1953 had discovered, you know, the double helix sequence in DNA. And those 25 years had consisted of, you know, many scientists around the world learning how to work with DNA and learning particularly how to utilize it, you know, what we call genetic engineering, how to use genetic sequences to produce safer recombinant versions of products that didn't need to be sourced from virally contaminated sources. And as those products were coming along and those technologies were coming along, they offered the promise then of the next generation of hemophilia therapies that biotechnology companies would advance.
Fantastic. Did you go directly with Henry or did you follow him sometime afterwards? And tell us a little bit about getting to Genzyme and what was that like when you got there?
Well, you know, it's a funny story, Chris, that you ask. And this story is actually recounted in another book. I'm happy to recommend to your listeners some other great books that actually good friends of mine have written. But this is recounted in a book that's actually a biography of Henry Tremere called Conscience and Courage by John Hawkins that came out a couple of years ago. And in the book, it recounts when I was consulting for Henry, when Henry was at Baxter and I was at Bain, he was considering going to Genzyme. And he asked me as a favor, as a friend, to look at the business plan and tell him what I thought. And I reviewed it. And after reviewing it, you know, I went back to talk to him and I said, Henry, that's crazy. That's never going to work. Well, you know, and I said, if you do the math, you know, Genzyme was then in the early stages of considering a therapy for a rare genetic disease, much rarer than hemophilia, called Gaucher disease. And when you looked at how much it took to develop drugs, and when you looked at what it would provide to provide a return on the investment to investors to develop a drug for Gaucher disease, you know, it was clear from the math that the cost would be $200,000 to $250,000 a year. And at that time, the most expensive therapies, drugs in the world cost about $25,000 a year. And I said to Henry, nobody's going to pay $200,000 a year for a drug. And he said, He said, look, he said, the question is, does society want these patients treated? We want these children with Gaucher disease. We have the ability to have them live normal, long, healthy lives. Do we want to give them that, or do we want to condemn them to this life of, you know, lifetime disability and early death? He said, if we want them to have a healthy life, this is what it will cost. And he said, I believe if we act responsibly and explain this to society, to healthcare systems and payers around the world, they will understand and accept it. And that's exactly what turned out to happen. So to answer your question, I didn't join him at the outset, but a couple of years later, you know, Seradaze was just in the process of being approved. And I thought, okay, this is too interesting to miss. And so I joined him and I spent the next 20 plus years there.
I love that. Part of the art of a well-lived life is sometimes pivoting, right? And so and be governed by the data, right? When the facts tell you that something is a good idea that you thought was a bad idea, you got to be open to that. Do you think that Genzyme, was it a natural fit for Henry, you and others who came in, or did the company have to be molded and changed?
It was very small. Henry wasn't the founder. A man named Henry Blair, who deserves a lot of credit as well, was the founder. And Genzyme in the early years was what was sometimes called a tools company, you know, and people used the gold rush analogy. And many of the miners were looking for gold, but gold was, you know, hard to find and high risk. But if you provided the tools, the picks and shovels, you know, it was less profitable, but it was kind of a steady business. And Genzyme was actually founded on a business of kind of diagnostic reagents and intermediates, you know, lower value, lower risk, but steady, stable income. But it had the aspiration to use that base to, you know, make the investments into higher risk and more rewarding drug discovery. So Genzyme always had a culture of being different. It was like Baxter. It was never like a pharma company. And Henry had a conscious philosophy of recruiting mavericks into the company. Very few people at Genzyme came from big pharma. Many were entrepreneurs. Some came from academia. Some came from, you know, practices of medicine or law or consulting, where people, I think, in many ways were more oriented toward being independent thinkers. They thought of people as, you know, clients and peers and partners, not as bosses. They didn't have that kind of hierarchical, top-down, rigid structure. And that created a culture which was very dynamic. And, you know, you had to have a high tolerance for chaos. There were no clear organizational rules, like a partnership, right? There's no organizational structure. It's, hey, we all have a common mission here. You know, there's a mission and we all need each other to succeed. And let's focus on how do we achieve the mission rather than, you know, where's my lane and where's your lane?
That's fascinating. And I guess that's one of the themes that I took away from the book, is that mavericks and people who are willing to bet on mavericks have been essential kind of at all stages in the development of the biotech industry, more so maybe even in most other industries. Do you think that's fair, or do you think it's similar to other industries?
No, I do think it's fair. And, you know, the biotech industry is a very unusual industry. The economics, the dynamics, it's about the highest risk, highest return industry you can find, right? There are very few industries where companies are founded and, you know, spend tens of millions of dollars, sometimes, often, of course, hundreds of millions of dollars before they generate any revenue. And so to be successful, you need people who think long term and who have a vision of where they want to get, what the value they want to contribute and help contribute to long term is, and are willing to take very high levels of risk. You know, I quote Henry all the time. He's still my kind of my mentor and my role model. And one of his, you know, common sayings was, this is not for the faint of heart. You know, and you have to have conviction. You have to decide that you're in this to win it and you're going to stick with it. And the history of these companies, Chris, as you know well, you know, we described many other great companies in the book, of course, you know, Vertex, Alnylam, Amicus, BioMarin, Ultragenyx, so many companies. And the common theme in all of them is if you read their business plans and even their, you know, when they went public, their IPO plans, almost every single company failed at what it first tried to do. And the question was, you know, did they give up? And some companies, of course, did give up. But the companies that were successful, they were committed to the mission and they were committed to learning from what failed and finding another way to achieve the goal. And that, you know, that takes people with a very strong sense of conviction and a long-term commitment to achieving that goal.
That's a point that's probably relevant for pretty much anybody who's listening. That idea of grit and loyalty to a vision for what you're doing, not necessarily to a specific course of action, is, I think, a really powerful lesson. One of the most interesting sort of byproducts, I guess, of the biotech revolution has been its impact on the city of Boston. I'm old enough to remember when East Cambridge was a bit of a wasteland. And, you know, now it is chock-a-block with biotech firms and investors and the like. Why do you think Boston ended up being so central to this revolution? Will you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. As I sit here talking to you from Boston, you know, I've been very fortunate and privileged to be part of that for at least the last 30 plus years. And I think there are a couple of reasons. You know, one is the fundamentals of successful biotechnology, drug development, orphan drug development, they can only come out of the highest levels of science and medicine. And Boston is blessed with obviously some of the world's leading research institutions. Many of the great fundamental discoveries have come out of places like MIT and Harvard and the other great universities in Boston. And then, of course, you also need great medical centers. You need clinicians and, you know, physician scientists, physicians who are treating patients, but also doing research to develop new therapies. And of course, you know, from Mass General to Brigham to the Dana-Farber, Boston Children's, you know, Boston has been blessed with some of the world's finest hospitals. But the last ingredient actually is sometimes maybe the least understood, and that's entrepreneurship and venture capital. Boston happens to be the home, really, of venture capital. The first venture capital firms in the world, in the modern world, were founded in Boston. And some of that, you know, came out of a Harvard Business School, a spin out potentially in some respects. But there's a long tradition of high risk, let's say, capital in Boston, going back actually quite honestly to the early, you know, whaling expeditions and the international shipping fleets that came out of, you know, the Boston Harbor to travel around the world and bring back and trade around the world. And there was a tradition of long-term investment capital, high-risk capital, and a tradition of entrepreneurs who came together to say, hey, there's financing here to support high-risk long-term investment, and let's take advantage of that to build things.
So that makes a lot of sense. And I think we see that across industries. This is in some ways the story of Silicon Valley and the rise of the California venture ecosystem. The biotech investment ecosystem is particularly strong in Boston. Will you talk a little bit about Third Rock and the birth of that and kind of how that might have served as a model? That was a fascinating story, I thought.
Yeah, you know, at the end of the book, I try to look forward, but the book does look back because I think looking back gives us a lot to learn from and build upon. And I'll answer your question, if I might, in two parts. And I'll actually start briefly by talking about the pharmaceutical industry and what happened in the pharmaceutical industry, you know, in the 1960s and 70s that led to the orphan drug revolution was that as companies had passed over many generations and decades from entrepreneurial founders and visionary scientists who started the companies, as they'd grown much larger and passed through many generations, they'd fallen into the hands of more conservative, financially oriented managers who were more risk averse and more oriented toward trying to generate safe profits as opposed to, let's say, swinging for the fences or doing something transformational. And a very similar thing happened in the venture capital community. There was an early generations of venture capital around the founding of Genentech. You know, Genentech was co-founded by a scientist and a venture capitalist, as were many biotech companies. But again, that was in 1980. And, you know, 25 years, a generation later, by the early 2000s, many of those funds had passed on to other generations of leaders, and they had become more conservative. And if you went to venture capital firms in those years, they would tell you, well, the question everybody got asked, and any entrepreneur got asked when he talked to an investor is this going to be a product company or a platform company? Because it can't be both, because we can't afford to invest in both. So you have to pick one or the other. And that's kind of a short-sighted strategy because you need products, but products are so high risk and fail so often that companies that don't have a platform to, let's say, rebuild on and generate next generation products from are very unlikely to succeed.
And Jim, our listeners will probably know what you mean by a platform company, but will you expand on that for a second?
Sure. I mean, the distinction basically is, you know, the end goal of biotechnology, like drug development, is to have therapeutic products that are able to treat patients and that are approved to treat patients. But those products are built on some kind of a technology platform. And the platform is, are you going to develop monoclonal antibodies? Or are you going to develop small molecules? Or are you going to use RNA therapeutics? Or are you going to use gene therapy or gene editing? And is this company going to be one that tries to advance a platform to build the next generation of small molecule discovery or the next generation of recombinant proteins or the next generation of gene therapy, and then license out your technology to other pharma companies to develop the products? And so the thinking was you couldn't do both. You couldn't invest both in the development of a broad scientific platform that would generate drugs and also invest in the development of those drugs themselves. And so Third Rock, you know, came up with this model that was captured in the phrase product engine company. And it was both products and an engine to generate new products. And the other aspect that made that work was in earlier years, a typical Series A, a typical first venture round for a startup company, you know, would be very small, maybe $20 to $30 million. And it would be syndicated across, you know, a number of investors who would be looking at when can they, you know, get their exit. Third Rock believed in much larger initial rounds. A typical Third Rock Series A would be $55 million. And Third Rock would try to keep as much of that as it could to itself. And again, you'll be amused to hear, Chris, when I first talked to Mark Levin about this, I told him that was crazy.
yeah, spread the risk, right?
Right, way too high risk and very counter to the conventional thinking. But it turned out that if you were able to assemble the right group of people around the table behind that investment and reach out very broadly to truly world-class scientists outside the fund and bring them to the table and bring them in as partners and, you know, co-founders in the company, then you could make that model work. And that's what Third Rock did by making big bets at long-term investments on visionary transformational companies. It had tremendous success. You know, many of its companies have brought, I mean, last time I looked, I think, I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, more than 15 products have been approved already from Third Rock companies. Many companies have achieved billion-dollar plus valuations, and many companies have products in late stages of clinical development right now. And it became, in many ways, the model for the venture community. It became not investing over the transom. See, the other aspect, if I could add one more point to that, is firms in those years were investing in business plans that people sent into them. You know, somebody would look at a business plan and a venture capital firm would decide whether to invest. But if you're investing in those kinds of business plans, you know, kind of like in the stock market, you can't beat the market, right? You were getting, you know, at best the same return that the average firm in the industry was getting. If you founded a company yourself, if you incubated a company internally, and if you were able to do it, well, then you could generate returns for your investors that reflected the value that those companies were creating. And so that model, I think it's fair to say, has significantly changed the venture capital landscape. And today, more of the largest and most successful venture capital firms incubate their own companies internally than invest in business plans that are submitted to them.
It may be really obvious, but the other thing that all of these venture investors have had is a sort of deep scientific knowledge inside of the venture firm so that they could make smart decisions about how to identify these converging lines. Is that right? Or how important do you think that is?
No, it's absolutely right. I think the two things that were the ingredients for success, going back again to what it is that drives, you know, success in developing drugs, is world-class science and a patient centricity, you know, and being patient-driven. And one of the things that attracted me to Third Rock after I left Genzyme was that it had that same value of being patient-centered and patient-driven. And as Third Rock was, as we were thinking about founding these companies, we would have patient organizations at the table with us, and we would be very closely engaging with them in terms of understanding the patient journey, the disease burden, you know, what would represent a transformational therapy. And it's that closeness to the patient that really gives you the ability to guide the science in a way that will create the kind of benefit that you're looking to create.
Terrific. I'm going to switch gears a little bit. You talk in the book about the importance of the Orphan Drug Act and the sort of improbability of that being passed. Will you tell a little bit about that story? First, why did it matter? And then why was it so hard to get done?
Yeah, you know, I was talking to a group the other day, and the framework that occurred to me around this was thinking about this as a series of miracles, which is really, I think, what it's been. And, you know, the Orphan Drug Act was one of the first miracles that kind of sparked the whole orphan drug revolution. And what happened was, at that time, you know, again, as I mentioned earlier, these pharmaceutical companies were very financially oriented, and they all thought that you couldn't make money on rare genetic diseases, and so they would never try to develop a drug for them. Not only would they not try to develop a drug, but there was a case where a patient, a family, had a disease. It was Tourette syndrome. A woman named Abby Myers, and I tell this story in the book, had a son with Tourette syndrome, and there was a drug that worked for Tourette syndrome, but the company that was developing at the time was pursuing it in a clinical trial for schizophrenia, which is a much larger and presumably more profitable indication. When the drug failed in schizophrenia, the company pulled it off the market, even for Tourette's patients, because they thought they couldn't make any money on it. And so Abby Myers was so outraged by that she joined with other patients, and they went to Washington. And by a miracle, second miracle, they found a congressman, Henry Waxman, a very influential leader in the healthcare field, who had a constituent who had been denied a drug for Huntington's disease. And Henry Waxman was trying to help figure out how could this problem be solved. So he started holding congressional hearings, and nobody came. And the pharma industry opposed them, and nobody cared. And then here's the next miracle. The hearings came to the attention of an actor who those of us who were above a certain age remembered well, named Jack Klugman. And Jack Klugman was then starring in a television drama called Quincy M.E., or Medical Examiner. And Jack had a brother named Maurice, who was his producer, who had a rare disease. And they heard about this, and they thought, hey, maybe they could do something to help. So they dedicated two episodes of Quincy to the plight of patients with rare diseases. And they called out this bill and these hearings. And Congress was flooded with letters all over the country. Tens of thousands of letters came into Congress on behalf of support for the bill. And people protested outside the offices of senators. And so the bill was approved by Congress. And then the last miracle, Ronald Reagan was then the president. And given his political philosophy, he announced, the bill was passed just at the end of 1982, and he announced just as he was going on Christmas vacation that he was going to veto the bill when he came back because he didn't believe in it. During Christmas vacation, he went out to Palm Springs with his wife, Nancy, and many women who were supporters of the bill got access to friends of Nancy's, and they explained the situation to them, and they persuaded her that it would be heartless and inhumane to veto the bill. And so when he came back, although having announced that he was going to veto it, Reagan signed the bill the day he came back, and the bill became law on January 3rd of 1983.
Wow, that's a crazy story.
Why did it matter? Talk to us a little bit about what changes that unleashed at FDA and in general.
Well, it did a couple of things. I mean, the first, like a lot of things in life, was it raised awareness, you know, and it raised awareness of the fact that there were all these diseases out there and there were all these patients, and these patients were motivated and they were moving to get things done. But it also provided some very tangible benefits. It made it less expensive to get into the FDA. It reduced filing fees and startup costs and things like that. It gave some market exclusivity at the end to ensure that there would be some return, that if the patents expired, there'd still be an ability to have exclusivity to generate, you know, a profit. And it provided for much more informal consultation with the FDA along the way to try to match the needs of these rare diseases to the regulatory framework. And then, you know, with those in place, then companies started thinking about, okay, what could they do? But even then, I would say, to be honest, few companies, you know, really jumped on it right away. And what really happened, I think it's fair to say that most companies and investors were still very skeptical, but Genzyme jumped on this. And Henry joined Genzyme, left Baxter, right after the Orphan Drug Act was passed because he saw what this could catalyze. And I think it's fair to say that it was Genzyme's success with the first real orphan drug for Gaucher disease, Seradaise, and then its successor, Serazyme, and Genzyme's ability to get that launched around the world and provide access to patients and have governments and healthcare systems around the world reimburse it. That's what really triggered, in many ways, the orphan drug revolution within the biotechnology industry.
So basically, everyone is watching and they see first this drug get approved and then get reimbursed successfully, not just in the United States, but around the world. And then that somewhat opens the floodgate into rare disease. Because at BioRossi, we run clinical trials. Rare disease is a focus for us. And I certainly can attest that the thinking has changed a lot on that in the ensuing years. Did you experience that? Was that sort of an overnight change? In other words, from one year to the next, suddenly were there lots of rare disease companies securing funding or the like? Did it take a lot longer to kind of grow?
It was the funding that really accelerated quickly. You know, the science, of course, had been building gradually. And there are many, of course, inspiring, you know, geneticists and researchers around the world who had been understanding the, you know, medical genetics, genetic basis of disease, and many, many scientists who had been thinking about how you could develop these recombinant products as therapies. Roscoe Brady at the NIH, who did the work on Gaucher disease, discovering that glucocerebrosidase could be an effective therapy for Gaucher disease, was an example of many scientists working on genetic diseases like that. But what they couldn't get was funding. And it was investors who were really catalyzed by the financial success of Genzyme. And, you know, Roscoe used to tell the story that for many years, he couldn't get any company to talk to him. You know, and after Serazyme was approved and became successful, he couldn't get people away from him. His phone was ringing off the hook with people wanting to talk to him about investing in the next therapy. And that was true of many physician scientists who've been kind of, you know, laboring in obscurity, funded by the NIH, funded by some academic institutions. But it was really that success that unleashed investment in those programs.
Got it. You talked a little bit about the importance of advocacy in getting the Orphan Drug Act passed, but will you talk more broadly about the role that patient advocacy plays in rare disease and orphan drugs?
Yeah, it plays in many, many ways. You know, it plays in guiding scientists. I'm just back from a conference organized by the Global Genes Group, and which brings together hundreds of small and mid-sized patient organizations. And the first thing they do is, you know, gather researchers and inspire researchers and fund researchers and work with companies, as I described earlier, and thinking about drug development. But they also advocate for policies. And that's a very important role because we can't take the orphan drug revolution for granted. There are many people, there are calls all the time. We hear about them in the press for reducing drug prices and for capping drug prices. And the fact is, those initiatives tend to be led by insurance companies who are looking to reduce the amount of money they have to pay. But patients don't actually pay. You know, no patient pays the list price of these drugs, $200,000, $250,000 a year. No one could. But the thing that makes the system work and the way the system is supposed to work, 93% of Americans now have some form of health insurance, private or Medicare or exchanges, Medicaid. And all of those programs by law, have to cover any FDA-approved drug. And so they do. And so what patients face is, you know, the co-pays and out-of-pocket costs, deductibles, that they have in their insurance policies. And those have been rising steadily every year, particularly for expensive drugs. And so what I think it's important for people to know is that capping drug prices and putting price controls in place for drugs, the only thing that's going to do is reduce innovation and investment in biotech drugs and increase insurance company profits. And so only if people understand the economics behind this and act in their own interest and the interest of, you know, potentially their children and grandchildren, will this revolution be sustained.
Yeah, I think you're right. That is not a commonly understood view broadly. There's a sense of big pharma as bad guys who are trying to profiteer on people's health. I think it's maybe worth you saying even one more sentence about this, about the importance of access to higher prices to fund these, to create these treatments for rare and orphan diseases.
Developing these drugs takes hundreds of millions of dollars. And investors, you know, they're good people, but they have a responsibility to maximize the return on their investment. So if they believe that they can't get a return on investing in orphan drugs or biotechnology, they can invest anywhere else. And actually, Chris, as you probably know, that's happening right now. You know, there was a flowering of investment in biotechnology and orphan drugs, genetic engineering, gene therapies in the 2019-2020 period. But today, because of reimbursement challenges, because of regulatory hurdles that are significantly delaying the approval of drugs, and because of the threat of price controls, this field is today in what some people call a kind of a nuclear winter of investment. Investment is at nearly an all-time low. And every week, if you follow the industry today, every week, articles that are coming out are not about new investments in research. They're about cutbacks. They're about companies, you know, terminating programs, laying people off, scaling back their research, in some cases going out of business, because investors today are looking at this environment and they're saying, hey, with all these threats of price controls, with the lack of adequate reimbursement, with the regulatory hurdles being so high, you know what? I think I can make more money elsewhere. And I, as a big investment fund, you know, I have a responsibility to my investors to put my money in other industries.
Where do you see that going, Jim? Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think you can't be paying attention to industry press and not draw the conclusion that you've drawn. Do you think we're in an extended winter, or do you think that the promise of the drugs is so high that eventually, you know, funding comes back?
I think it actually depends on what happens and what people do. You know, we've seen a lot of cycles, and there's tremendous promise that suggests the cycle should come back. But if, for example, Congress were to pass, let's say, draconian price controls, you know, I think actually the nuclear winter could last a very long time. Seriously, because that's the thing that investors, that's kind of like a red flag for investors. And when they see that, given all the costs and all the risks of developing these drugs, if there's no promise of making a return, then why would I make this investment? So I hope the underlying value of the science would suggest that things should come back, but the political and policy climate could chill that investment for a long time if it goes in the wrong direction.
Yeah, we'll have to cross our fingers. Well, coming back to the patient advocacy stuff that we talked about, if someone who's listening has a family member or loved one who gets diagnosed with an orphan disease or a rare disease, do you have any advice for them? I imagine you do, given what we've been talking about.
Yeah, I think the world has changed dramatically for families who do experience these diseases at a birth. And the first thing I would say is, obviously, the first people to talk with are physicians and caregivers. And today, you know, particularly in the, let's say, you know, academic medical centers, you know, leading hospitals, these diseases are well understood. Almost every major academic medical center has a major program of research in genetic diseases. And, you know, patients typically get referred to them, you know, quickly. But diagnosis is actually a major issue still today. The patients, people, families talk about the diagnostic odyssey. They talk about being misdiagnosed for many years. They talk about being undiagnosed for many years. And the real tragedy behind that, as you know, Chris, is these diseases, most of these diseases, are kind of relentlessly progressive from a young age. And there are many therapies that are, you know, in development today appear to be highly effective if they're administered very early stages of life, in infancy or in the first year of life. But if the patient is not diagnosed until years later, the therapies can still have effect, but some of the damage is irreversible. And so things like newborn screening are a very important priority.
Yeah, That's great. I think that's really good advice. All right. I want to shift to the future. So you've had through your various chairs a bunch of interesting seats into both the past, the present, but also kind of where the future of these therapies is headed. What's exciting to you now? What do you think is on the near-term horizon?
Well, I think one of the most amazing and promising things is that, you know, over the last 25 years and kind of the first generation of orphan therapies, many very effective therapies have been developed, but all of them tend to require chronic administration. So they provide a therapeutic benefit, protein replacement, you replace a defective protein, but because they have a half-life, you know, they're excreted out of the system, they have to be readministered. And so patients have to go in for therapy. You know, they have to go to the hospital, typically maybe every 2 weeks, maybe every month, for a what could be a 4+ hour IV infusion to get the drug readministered. Today, the next generation of therapies for these genetic diseases are one-time treatments, gene therapy or gene editing technologies, which hold the promise that a patient will be treated once, and by correcting the gene, such as the gene produces the protein on an ongoing basis, that can provide a lifetime of benefit. And, you know, a few of those drugs have been approved, many are in development, but there are many challenges we can come back to as to what's limiting their development, but that is one of the most promising fields of development for patients with these diseases today.
Cell and gene therapies are getting a lot of attention. Are there other things that, other kind of broad themes that you see that are attracting a lot of investment dollars or that you think are promising and exciting?
Well, I think one of the things that, you know, people should understand is that, first of all, again, maybe to put it in context, you know, one thing I think people should understand is there are 7,000 rare genetic diseases that have been identified. And collectively, you know, each one only affects, you know, maybe a few, in some cases, a few 100,000, but in most cases, only a few thousand, or in many cases, only a few hundred people. But they can strike any family. You know, some people think that genetic diseases, as they say, run in families. And there is some family pattern of inheritance, but there are also many diseases that strike without any prior family history of a disease. And so the question is for people, what do they do? How do people prepare for that? And to your question, you know, many of these are what are often called ultra orphan diseases. And I think one of the big opportunities and the big challenges ahead is to figure out, you know, in the first 25 years of this revolution, we've figured out how to treat and make economically viable ways to treat the larger genetic diseases. But to treat these ultra orphan diseases is a huge opportunity, but a major challenge in terms of finding the way to, you know, make it work economically to support the investments required.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. One more technology question. I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you how important you think AI and sort of the whole AI revolution that we're seeing unfold is going to be over the next years for drug discovery. Do you see this as a sort of critical? We're certainly seeing a lot of companies that have AI in their name these days. How much do you think that changes the game as we move forward?
I think it will. I think the question is on what pace. And like many technologies, you know, they take a long time to develop. And sometimes there's a little hype that gets ahead of itself. And sometimes there are setbacks. It's a little hard to predict the pace at which AI and machine learning will impact drug development in a big way. There are certainly many people working on it. And I think it will have a lot of value. So it's a little hard to predict. But I think, I guess I would say it's coming. You know, it's going to take a while before it has a broad-based impact.
Got it. I want to finish out talking a little bit about advice that you might have for young people who are beginning their careers. And you have a lovely quote in the book from your mentor, Henry Termeer, that says, "You need courageous people who pursue their goals, believing it is all extremely worthwhile, and who surround themselves with highly skilled and equally passionate people." This is his formula for success here. A wonderful, motivating statement. What would you say to someone who is listening, who's early in their career and interested in getting involved?
Well, I would say that, you know, there are a lot of ways to do that. I'm not a scientist or a physician. And, you know, some people think, oh, well, if I'm not a scientist, I can't work in biotechnology. And that's absolutely not true. It takes people from all disciplines to contribute and to build these organizations. And I would say for people who are interested, you know, talk to people you know, talk to people in the field. I think that the best advice to give young people is look for leaders who you can respect and even admire to become mentors and to become, you know, part of those organizations, companies that have a strong moral compass. And usually, you know, people know about those companies and organizations. And if you talk with people in your community and ask them, who are the companies in this field and who are the people in this field that you respect and admire? And then, you know, trying to find a way to get connected with them. I think that's the best way for a young person to find a path to making the kind of contribution and the kind of reward that we all hope to make in life.
Wonderful, Jim. Okay, the book is Inside the Orphan Drug Revolution. I highly recommend it, both for its picture of the past, the present, and the future for biotech and rare disease and orphan drugs. Jim, thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the latest episode of Few and Far Between. If you enjoyed this podcast or have suggestions for future episodes, please get in touch with us. You can email us at fewandfarbetween@biorossi.com or contact us on our website at biorossi.com.